ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Charismatic, rich, stylish, glamorous. Christopher and Pixie Skase were the it couple of the 80s.
Getting an invitation to a Skase party was prized real estate.
But when their business empire teeters, it's Pixie who pays a massive price.
A sort of gilded cage that she was a prisoner in.
I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Cancel culture has ruined lives and livelihoods. What is at its core, though, isn't new, is it? Public shaming, ostracism, vigilante justice, that human instinct to shut people down for what they say or do. But it has taken on a distinctly feverish pitch in this algorithmic age. Well, today on Big Ideas, high-profile defamation barrister Sue Chrysanthou. Is it time to cancel culture? Hello, it's Natasha Mitchell here with ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas. Her name is associated really with some of Australia's biggest defamation battles. Called to the bar in 2004 and appointed a senior counsel, or SILC, in 2020, Sue Chrysanthou represented the actor Jeffrey Rush. He won. Journalist Lisa Wilkinson, she also won. And people of all political persuasions too. The Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young, she won that case too. The Victorian Liberal MP Moira Deeming, yep, you guessed it, they won. Today though, Sue is not talking about defamation, but its poor cousin, cancellation. Is our society being governed by the rule of law or the rule of the mob? And what is this instinct to shut down those with whom we disagree? Sue Chrysanthou delivers the 2025 James Merrill's Fellowship in Law Lecture, jointly held by the University of Melbourne Law School and the Victorian Bar.
Thank you so much, all of you, for coming to hear me speak. Melbourne has become a home away from home for me in the last couple of years. I've run a few cases here, which I've enjoyed thoroughly. And I was so pleased to be invited here to speak to you all about a topic that has been of interest and of concern to me for a number of years. For those of you who haven't read the advertisement for tonight, I'm making a case against cancel culture. In the blurb on the advertisement, I described cancel culture as not merely immature, but also infantile. I've said that it eschews rationality in favour of the mentality of the mob, using modern technology to do so. And I'm going to argue and hope to convince you tonight that it is fundamentally corrosive and ought to have no place in academic or public life. It wasn't a subtle ad, and I didn't leave much of an air of mystery about where I'm headed. And I'm sorry about that. But this is a topic which I discuss often with my children and with my husband. And I think standing in this place, in a university, it's a topic that all people who are interested in thoughtful discussion should consider. What is cancel culture? Well, of course, helpfully, there's a substantial debate about that. So I'm going to define what I am going to be speaking about tonight. And I'm sure there's broader definitions that other people would use, but what I'm talking about tonight is public shaming. Public shaming with the intent or the cause or the effect of somehow removing or significantly degrading a person in their position in society. The point of it is to substantially and negatively affect a person's status in the community. The reason for the shaming, within my definition, could be to silence a person because the group doing the cancelling doesn't agree with what the person says or what the person is perceived to believe. That's one type of cancellation. Another type of cancellation is where a group has perceived that someone has engaged in some sort of conduct that warrants public shaming. Now, the second group, the conduct group, falls into two subcategories. Alleged conduct, so just an assertion of conduct, or admitted or established conduct. And I'll be talking about those two different types of things. There's a third type of cancel culture, which I'll only mention briefly now, but I won't discuss at length this evening, and that is corporate boycotting. In my view, corporate boycotting is not the same type of cancellation as the public shaming of a person. First of all, because one's a corporation and one's an individual, and the effects are quite different. It doesn't carry the same level of stigmatism. I also need to disclose one of the reasons why I'm not going to be speaking against corporate boycotting this evening is because I have a conflict of interest. I myself have engaged in corporate boycotting. I was a teenager, and I won't disclose the name of the company. Suffice to say that for a number of years, I carried around a red tote bag with the word McShit on it. As far as I'm aware, the company still operates in some countries. So, it would seem my attempt at cancel culture, well before its time, was also entirely ineffective. Now, the other thing I should say, because I am somewhat known for running defamation cases, this is not a lecture about defamation. Defamation is a subset of cancel culture and can be intertwined with it. But I'm not talking about, and I know I have clients here who wouldn't like this term, mere defamation this evening. I'm talking about something that goes well beyond that. So in relation to the two forms of cancel culture for discussion tonight, namely cancelling people for opinions or cancelling people for conduct, they both involve name-calling. Name-calling by a group of people or the media or both, labelling a person in a highly uncomplimentary way. It tends to be repetitive. It's repetitive and it just keeps going and going. And the effect of that repeat name-calling, whether online or by the media or both, is that the label becomes permanent. It is a permanent label, such as sex pest, disgraced, misogynist, racist, transphobic, anti-Semitic or Islamophobic. It is a system whereby, rather than engaging with the person's opinions or beliefs or conduct and describing it in order to engage with it, the person is just labelled. And that label sticks. It is a permanent stigmatism. Now, on any view, if that sort of conduct occurred face to face, if I were to walk up to any one of you and start name-calling you in that way, that would be frowned upon, at least in some social circles. It'd be a form of bullying. It'd be an act of intimidation. It would be harassment. It often escalates to the incitement of hatred towards a person and even violence. If it occurred face to face, I could be charged with assault. Yet, it is happening daily online with very few criminal outcomes or criminal charges, even though the legislature has tried to recognise some of the conduct as criminal in recent times. On occasion, and this has happened in relation to clients I have had, the person is so shamed and so removed from society, they engage in self-harm, or they at least consider it. It is similar or comparable to severe bullying in a school playground, where a gang of youths target another child because of some disagreement or apparent defect in that child. Too fat, too thin, too smart, wrong coloured hair, wrong religion, some form of disability, had a funny smelling lunch today. All sorts of socially unacceptable reasons to target another person. Yet online, this has become a daily occurrence. Abhorrent bullying that any rational parent teaches her children is unacceptable. Antisocial behaviour that adults who may have well-meaning jobs or positions in society but become animals online, wildly attacking others. What I'm going to look at this evening is how we've come to this. Where has this sort of behaviour come from? Why do people do it and why is it allowed? Why aren't there more penalties? Why as a society are we tolerating this? this sort of behaviour. It is, when analysed, the aggressive ruination of a person by a mob of people who have no personal knowledge of that person, most of whom have never met the person. A self-appointed crowd, not democratically elected. A self-appointed crowd who take it upon themselves to destroy someone. All of you, as you sit there, I'm sure, can think of examples that you have observed over the last decade of this sort of behaviour. I'm not going to go into the examples, but it's worth reflecting for a moment whether you've seen this sort of behaviour when you've been online or sometimes even in the mainstream media. I'm going to give you a history lesson. Now, I can tell from looking around there is quite a few know-it-alls in this crowd. So, bear in mind that there will be some artistic license with some of the historical facts. We're going to start in ancient Greece, where all good stories start. 500 BC, Athens, the birthplace of democracy, demokratia, which means rule by the people. In ancient Athens, key decisions were made in the agora, which was a meeting place for citizens to discuss political affairs, philosophy, and conveniently also a place to shop. Members of the community met in the ancient agora to debate decisions that needed to be made. One thing that was decided there was the temporary banishment of persons who threatened the fabric of Athenian society or democracy. And that is a process called ostracism. And it is a term often associated with modern-day cancel culture. Well, that is very unfair to the ancient Greeks, because what happened in the agora was an organised and fair system with democratic processes, very different to what now occurs in 2025 online. In the agora, every citizen of Athens was entitled to vote on the ostracism. Unlike cancel culture online, where a random group of individuals self-appoint themselves as the decision makers. In ancient Greece, the ostracism vote only occurred if there were 2 months' notice, so that there was a form of procedural fairness to the person the subject of the ostracism vote. In cancel culture online, you don't usually get much notice when people start posting horrible things about you. When the vote finally took place, names were scratched on a piece of pottery. And it was only if a quorum of citizens scratched a person's name that that person was ostracised. There is various historical texts about how many citizens were needed. One of those texts says 6,000 votes, so it wasn't insignificant. If that number was reached, that person would be sent out of Athens, but it was temporary. Their property was not forfeit. They had a right to return after 10 years. And when they returned, it was without stigma. So it was a very different democratic process, and importantly, was intended to serve as a punishment or a complete punishment once it was completed, which is not the case with online cancel culture. At the time, ancient Greece was at the forefront of society when it came to democracy, science, and philosophy. Socrates was teaching that freedom of discussion was an important fabric of society. And from that, universities, such as this one, often employ the Socratic method, which relies on the importance of listening to others. That's not how cancel culture works. So I don't think at this point we can blame the Greeks for what's going on here. What about the Romans? 50 BC, the Republic. Democracy was supposed to be a feature of ancient Rome. Debates would occur in the Senate, and the senators were elected representatives of the people, of the citizens of the Republic. In the Senate, there was discussion and arguments where the various senators sought to persuade each other and the public to their point of view. It is one of the bases of our current parliamentary system. If you're good at arguing and if you're persuasive, then you would win favour with the other politicians and with the members of the public. Now, a problem arose, and he was a handsome young man called Julius Caesar. He was very popular in the Senate, but not amongst some of his colleagues. He was sent out of Rome to lead an army in Gaul for a number of years in the hope that his popularity would wane in Rome. Well, that backfired. He came back to Rome, a very popular general indeed, having done very well in Gaul. Senators were concerned that his popularity would threaten the Republic and would threaten democracy. So they demanded that he return as a layperson, that he be stripped of his title as general, so that he would be diminished in society. Those of you who already know the story would know that he refused to do that. And he crossed the Rubicon, which is the basis of a saying, no turning back. I don't know why. Anyone seen the Rubicon? It is a highly unimpressive, shallow river. It's also called Fiumicino, which literally means little river. But anyway, he crossed the Rubicon as a general leading an army and re-entered Rome as an extremely popular and handsome fellow. So the die was cast. Long story short, and I'm sure there were people in the audience will argue with me about this, some lame excuses were put forward by a bunch of senators, giving rise to an apparent concern that Caesar wished to crown himself emperor. Historically, these lame excuses are called the last three straws. Now, whether you're pro or anti-Caesar, you'd agree they were pretty pathetic and tenuous excuses to kill someone. He refused to stand up when the Senate gave him some honours. Some random person put a diadem on his statue in the square, suggesting that maybe people thought he should be emperor. And Mark Antony followed up on that by putting a diadem on his head one day, which Caesar removed twice and said, I am Caesar, not Rex. Now, Rex obviously meant leader or king or emperor, but the senators who opposed Caesar said he was joking because Rex was a family name and he really did want to become emperor. So those were the last three straws. Now, a self-appointed group of men, 60 to 70 of them, led by Senator Brutus, decided that Caesar needed to die. This was not a democratic decision. It was a vigilante mob. So 60 to 70 men, honourable men, cancelled Caesar by stabbing him to death in 44 BC in the Taurus Argentina. Now, they argued that they were protecting the Republic, they were protecting democracy by, in a grotesque act of hypocrisy, murdering someone without a trial, without any vote, without any proper decision maker. And that act undermined democracy in Rome. It resulted in civil war and the fall of the Republic. Augustus was crowned emperor and Rome was never a republic again. So, what a great example of cancel culture. An unelected mob of people making decisions for others under the guise of the public good and behaving hypocritically. The result being quite a disaster in that instance.
And across Australia on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. And you can find all our recent episodes as podcast on the ABC Listen app. This is high-profile barrister Sue Chrysanthou speaking to a sold-out audience at the Melbourne Law School. Many keen to hear what she has to say. I'm Natasha Mitchell. It's great to be with you. Sue is making the case to cancel culture, which she believes is ruining not just public debate and personal lives, but our universities as well.
Now, the next 1,000 years is pretty boring. BC became AD. My husband wouldn't let me discuss the cancellation of Jesus Christ, so I'll move on from that. It was ineffective. In Europe, learning and scholarship was the province of the church. There was Dark Ages, there was Vikings. There was not much happening from my perspective. An important thing happened, though, in 1088, the first ever university, the University of Bologna. It's still there in Italy. And it was established as a learning institution independent of the church. It was somewhere where people could go to learn. And learning involved listening to others to expand knowledge, learning how to learn and how to think. The point of a university is not to turn up and shout down people who you disagree with. If you want that sort of echo chamber, just stay at home and hang out with your cousins or watch Fox News. All right, sorry, that's sidetracked. From about 1100 onwards and for the next few hundred years, another type of cancel culture emerged. In Europe and later in the Americas, a form of vigilante justice called tarring and feathering. Now, tarring and feathering has become a metaphor for modern-day cancel culture. It is not a complimentary comparison. Mobs of people would chase someone down, a self-appointed mob, without any due process or evaluation of evidence or even a formal decision maker. In some versions, hot tar would be poured on the person, sounds uncomfortable, and they would be covered in feathers. So some poor unsuspecting bird was also involved. In other versions, not as horrific, cold tar was used. And the point of it was that the tar would stick to the person's skin and unable to be removed unless the skin was ripped off. And the feathers would then stick to the tar, shaming the person and mocking them, so that they would be identified within the community as a person who warranted horrific attack, humiliation and shame. And that is the metaphor for modern day cancel culture. Not good. Those who agree with cancellation by an online mob, those who participate on it, are modelling themselves on this sort of behaviour. Galileo, 1930s, wrote about the Earth going round the sun, heliocentrism. We're back to the Italians. I'm trying not to be racist in any way, but they did like to get rid of people. Heliocentrism. He wrote a book, Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems. He believed that the Earth went around the sun, whereas the church relied on the teachings of people called geocentrists who believed that the Earth was the centre of the universe. Galileo described geocentrists as simpletons. Harsh, but in retrospect, accurate. He was convicted during the Roman Inquisition of heresy in 1633. His book was banned. It became part of the Index Librorum Prohibitorum. He was placed under house arrest for 9 years until his death. He was not allowed to interact with members of society. He was not allowed to work. He was cancelled, locked in his house, a genius who had many ideas, who could have contributed further to society, cut off from the community for his heresy. Now, this act occurred late in the Renaissance, a time of increasing political and artistic freedom. So it was an extremely serious act of cancellation, particularly at that time in Italy. What was the result? Well, over 100 years later, his book was unbanned. He got an apology in 1992, some 460 years after his death, and well after the expiration of the one-year defamation limitation period. I'm not sure if his lawyers sent an invoice or if it was paid. Now, an example of cancel culture, but something we can learn from. The people who cancelled him were wrong. They were wrong to ban his book. They were wrong to lock him up. They made a mistake in stopping the community from benefiting from his genius. It took them a long time to realise that, but in modern day cancel culture, how do those who are erasing someone from society, how do they know that they are not attacking the next Galileo? Because they've never met them. They have no personal knowledge of them. How do we know that someone important is not being erased? In the next few hundred years, two very important common law institutions, as we would recognise them today, emerged. Parliament, and even more importantly, the courts. The Houses of Parliament provided for structured debates where elected representatives of the people were allowed to and are allowed to speak freely. not as eloquently as we would like sometimes, if any of you have watched Question Time recently, but, you know, they get to talk. And they answer questions. And they get their turn. They shout at each other sometimes, but generally speaking, we get to hear what they have to say. And as voters, we get to decide who has persuaded us. In court, theoretically, the same thing is supposed to happen. Doesn't always happen. I don't always feel listened to. But theoretically, each side gets to present its evidence and its arguments, his or her arguments or its arguments, listen to the other side, respond to the other person's arguments, and the appointed agreed decision maker takes all of those things into account and forms a view. Now, those two institutions are an essential part of a functional democracy, and both of them are premised on freedom of discourse, listening to others who we disagree with. Despite the emergence of those two systems, there's one last historic event that I think we should think about, the Salem witch trials. Now, a lot of people think that this is an example in history of cancel culture. No, I say. The Salem witch trials were much more rational and fair and democratic than cancel culture in 2025. It's a counterexample. What happened in Massachusetts in 1692 and 1693 is worth taking a closer look at. More than 200 people were accused of being witches. The accusations were made by members of the community. Gossip, hearsay, wild speculation caused a person to be accused of being a witch. If you looked at a rose bush and it died 2 weeks later, you were a witch. If you were followed by a black cat, you were a witch. If you raise your eyebrows in a strange angle or at a strange angle, you were a witch. Those were some examples. Sounds a bit like cancel culture, I can see that. But this is an interesting fact that I wasn't aware of until I looked into this in the last few weeks. Out of the 200 people accused in those 2 years, only 30 were found guilty, 15%. So unlike cancel culture, where accusation is sufficient, where accusation results in shaming and penalty, in Salem, there was accusation and then there was a trial. Now, we don't need to really go in to the methods of adducing evidence during those trials. They were unusual. Out of the 30 people convicted, 19 were executed, 14 women and 5 men. Now, don't get me wrong, that's not good. If you all believe, as I do, that there are no such thing as witches, and there were not witches in Salem, then obviously all of those convictions were wrongful. But they are still more rational than the process of cancel culture as I've defined it. So think about that, cancel crowd. You are less rational than the Salem witch trials. Now, today, what are we dealing with today? I think it's fair to say what we've seen over the last decade is unprecedented. I can't find any moment in history which compares to what we are witnessing. The first category is the non-proved allegation. Now, the problem with the non-proved allegation is the gullibility of every person that appears to have a keyboard and a social media account. On social media, an allegation can be made by a person who has no personal knowledge of it, none whatsoever. Mere assertion. That allegation is then believed by others, it is promulgated by the believers, and it eventually becomes truth. The participants in that process can be entirely anonymous, which perhaps emboldens people to speak their truth online. I'll give you an example of the dissemination of a malicious false fact that occurred last year to one of my clients. He was not cancelled, but the speed with which he was called a murderer was unbelievable. Two social media accounts said that my client Benjamin Cohen, a student, was guilty of murdering 6 people at Bondi Junction Shopping Centre in Sydney. He was named and pictured on social media. In less than 12 hours, thousands of people believed it was fact online that he was the murderer. In 12 hours having started on two malicious social media accounts. That fact was presented as truth by one of Australia's national news networks. So in 12 hours, a completely innocent person that had absolutely no connection and nothing to do with six murders was presented as the murderer on national television. Now, that is a reflection of our society that none of us should be proud of. Mindless, lemming-like repetition of an allegation that people know nothing about. The willingness to retail as true serious allegations without any form of verification was surprising when it first started online a decade ago, but now it's just an everyday occurrence. There is a presumption of truth on the internet that we should all be concerned about. What about, so that's innocent people being cancelled, or at least where the allegations are in dispute. What about where the allegation is not in dispute? What about where a person has been proved beyond reasonable doubt in a court to have done something criminal or has admittedly engaged in some form of misconduct and there's no dispute that it's occurred, non-criminal conduct? Should those people be cancelled? Should those people be held up and repeatedly subject to public shaming and ridicule by the fact that they have done something that certain groups or many groups in the community think is worthy of approbation? Well, I say no. That's why we have a criminal justice system. It's not perfect, but it's been developed as best we can as lawyers to deal with findings of criminal guilt. It's been developed democratically. It's legislated by those who we have voted in to represent us. As lawyers, I would hope that we all agree that vigilantism is unacceptable. It is undemocratic. It falls outside the systems and norms of the social contract we've entered into as members of Australian society. The decision makers could be anyone, ignorant, acting in bad faith, or just crazy, meting out their own form of justice. Even when a person has made a mistake in their lives, whether it's criminal or non-criminal, they should not be subjected to this sort of public shaming, inflicting a permanent stigma on them outside of the criminal justice system. Our criminal justice system recognises that once a sentence is served, a person is allowed to re-enter society. We do not have the death penalty here. That's history. It was cancelled in the 60s, properly so. Then you have the next type of finding, the non-criminal finding, the non-admitted finding, but where there's some sort of finding, and this happens a lot in civil cases, finding short of criminal beyond reasonable doubt proof. Civil proceedings, tribunals, royal commissions, ICAC, workplace investigations. Should people be cancelled because of those findings? Well, standards of proof can be pretty low in those tribunals and even in civil courts. Evidentiary strictures are non-existent in some forums. Even in a civil court, I apologise, I think there are some judges in the crowd, the finding is it probably happened. Well, that means it might not have happened. Should a civil finding or something lesser warrant the permanent stigmatism of that person? The media love to label a person who's been the subject of criminal findings. Disgraced property developer, unethical financial advisor. Does that person deserve that label for life? Why do they deserve it? What is the benefit to our society for a person who has made an error to be harassed until they die? How does that benefit any of us? I cannot stand here and say that I've never made an error. I make errors on a daily basis in both my personal and professional life. I often undercook cakes. I'm criticised at home for that. But I'm not held up as the worst chef in the suburb. I'm given another chance to bake, even though I've made significant errors. How can it be said that every person who has made a mistake no longer holds any value in our community, in any context? A newer phenomenon, which I've noticed in the media, particularly over the last year, is that persons who refuse to disassociate themselves from those cancelled become shamed themselves. So, if the media has labelled a person disgraced or unethical or guilty of some sort of conduct, if I hang out with them, then I'm in deep trouble because I will be named and shamed in the press as a person supporting another person said by the media to be not worthy of society. Is this how we want our community to exist? I consider that sort of harassment from people who espouse freedom of speech an act of hypocrisy to criticise us for exercising our freedom of association. Freedom of association takes me to the final topic, and that is where persons are cancelled because of their opinions or their political affiliations or groups. And it is something that we are seeing on a daily basis. Freedom of speech is a term that is used by a lot of people to justify a lot of antisocial and despicable conduct. Many people who use freedom of speech to justify their conduct are using it to silence any person they don't agree with. It is not a proper exercise of freedom of speech to stop the freedom of someone else to speak. Again, an act of hypocrisy. If you're not clever enough to respond to the arguments of those you disagree with, keep quiet. Don't name call. Don't label bigot, fascist, Nazi. These sorts of names coming out merely because there's a disagreement of ideas or views on controversial topics. That results in abuse and intimidation and harassment and cancellation online. It doesn't end on social media. And this is the reason why I wanted to speak about this topic today. Because that sort of name-calling and harassment and abuse has been happening in universities. Going back to ancient Greece, of course, university is a place where we come to learn to listen to others and to particularly listen to those we disagree with. There's no point listening to people who agree with you and tell you what you already believe or what you already know. It is infantile behaviour to shut down discussion, and I really mean it is infantile. It reminds me of a toddler having a tantrum. Toddlers tantrum because they're yet to learn how to communicate properly. They're unable to express their feelings and their views because of their inability to use language. That is what happens when someone gets a megaphone and tries to speak over the top of another person because they don't like what they're saying. That is not an exercise of freedom of speech. It is abuse. Melbourne is the home of the public demonstration. Freedom of association is an independent right that we all have. It's an important right, and it complements freedom of speech. In the context of a public demonstration, both rights are being exercised. Associating with a group of people who are like-minded and speaking freely in public about a topic of importance to that group. It's something that should be allowed and respected, and it's something Melbourne should be proud of. But unfortunately, there is a strange phenomenon, particularly in Melbourne, that I learnt about because of a case I did recently. It is called the counter-protest. The counter-protest appears to be a group of people who turn up to a place to intentionally interfere with, disrupt, and speak over someone else's protest. Again, the hypocrisy is obvious. Trying to deploy freedom of speech to take away from another group their freedom of speech. That is not a proper exercise of either the right of association or of freedom of speech. That also happens online, where a group of people seek to drown someone out because they disagree with them. They use their own freedom of speech to shut down the speech of someone else. A few years ago, not in Melbourne, university students descended upon a visiting speaker, abusing, assaulting, screaming down that person. They did not wish to hear from him. They disagreed with things that he had said and done in the past. That was a shocking moment for me, because in my view, university students should listen to different perspectives, should learn to think for themselves, should learn to critically assess information, particularly in this time where there is so much false information online. They should learn how to assess information, weigh its believability and credibility, and that is an essential skill that all students should leave university with. Sadly, I've observed some students believe they already know everything. I've assumed that's what they think because they don't like listening to other people. Believing they already know everything, not wishing to listen to different perspectives, they'll fail to gain those essential skills. It's a trend that we've seen, and hopefully it changes as trends do. Now it is time to acknowledge my own hypocrisy. This evening I've sought to cancel a number of groups of people: university students, anonymous online keyboard warriors, name-calling journalists, counter-protesters, honourable Roman men, adhesive avianators, geocentrists, witches, and anyone who has a black cat. In honour of that gross hypocrisy, feel free to shame and humiliate me by highlighting one of my greatest personal failures. Google Maps reveals there are about a dozen McDonald's restaurants within 5 kilometres of where I'm standing. Bon appetit and good night.
Armed with her lawyer's reason and her deadpan sense of humour, it would be interesting to see her in court, wouldn't it? Sue Chrysanthou is our big thinker today on Big Ideas here on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app. The Sydney King's Council making the case against cancel culture with an audience at the University of Melbourne. Now Sue takes some questions from the audience with the assistance of fellow barrister James Waters.
So the first question, Sue, is this: what legal remedies should exist to prevent or enjoin cancel actions?
Okay, good question. I think that it depends on the extent of the action. I think we already have defamation if people are just publishing false claims online. If it gets to incitement of hatred, if it gets to harassment and bullying, we have the Commonwealth Crimes Act, which makes it a crime to intimidate and harass via a carriage service. I think that there needs to be more remedies in the Online Safety Act. The Online Safety Act was brought in to deal with extreme acts of bullying online, but I've found in my practice, unless it involves children, it's very difficult to satisfy the standard needed to come within those provisions. So I think I would like to see those provisions amended so that they cover more of this sort of conduct.
How do we move away from a cancel culture and to a culture of restoration?
Wow.
People. Your time starts now.
Okay. I thought you were going to ask me when the last time I had a Big Mac was. listening to people, starting in university. Lecturers should not be scared of students. I've spoken to a lot of lecturers and they are at the moment. They're scared of complaints. They're scared of teaching the subjects that they're there to teach. They're scared of discussing the important issues within those subjects. Universities need to support lecturers and academics to speak freely on topics without shame. Now, there aren't many people I ever agree with. You see me behave that way in court. I'm still grateful and happy to listen to what they have to say, and I enjoy responding to their spurious submissions. That is a sense of joy that I think all people in society should share. And I think that it should start in the university, and it should start with the university and the community supporting academics to do their job.
In your view, what is the, or where is the line between cancel culture on one hand and then the calling out of potentially dangerous behaviours and beliefs? Where does that line sit for you?
Well, I think I should say that there is laws that stop or that make unlawful certain types of speech. So if a person is engaging in unlawful speech, they should be called out as doing that. Obviously, defamation is one type of unlawful speech, There's misleading and deceptive conduct. There's racial vilification. There's incitement of hatred. There's all sorts of laws which make certain conduct unlawful, and that should be dealt with within the legal system. I think that the vigilante justice is what I have a problem with, particularly where the conduct is not actually proved or it's in dispute. I've had many clients who have suffered the effects of allegations online that are just passed on as fact. I had a client once, I remember getting a phone call from a solicitor saying, this client wants to brief you. And I rolled my eyes and went, oh, not him. Like, what excuse does he have for what he's done? I believed it. There had been such a dissemination of this allegation against this politician, I had assumed that it was true. I felt very bad afterwards because it wasn't true.
Did you take the brief?
I took the brief. We won a couple of times against a couple of people, but it was so widespread that when I first heard that he wanted legal help, even I assumed that the allegation must be true because of the way it had been disseminated on social media and throughout all types of media.
So this next question then relates to politics. Do you think that politics has become too focused on cancellation of personalities rather than itself politics? And what do you think the consequences are for our modern Australian democracy?
I think that we can't categorise every politician in the same group. We have a variety of types of politicians, as we've particularly seen over the last week on the news, who have their own personalities, but we have to respect, have been elected in a democratic process. Those people, elected as they have been, should be entitled to speak in Parliament and to express their views without cancellation. If we don't like what they say, we can vote them out next time. I mean, that's how politics works. If people are elected, they should feel free to speak on behalf of the people who have voted for them. And we obviously strongly disagree with a lot of what we hear from some politicians, but that is our process. It's not a perfect one, but it's one that's developed and it's one that we agree to as Australian citizens.
What is your view on sex offender registers that the public can view that list people after their sentences have been served?
Blacklisting, it's a known thing. I think that, again, within the criminal justice system, if there are crimes which necessarily need to be recorded to protect vulnerable people in the community, then the criminal justice system needs to take that into account. If it benefits the community to allow those people to leave jail more quickly on the basis that they are recorded, then that might be of some benefit. I mean, this is a complicated question. It depends on the offence. It depends on whether it affects how long they're in jail. I think there's a lot of factors. I don't think there can be a blanket list. But ultimately, it's something that our criminal justice system should consider and look at. And again, these are things that legislators look at, and we voted for these people to pass these laws. So any process that results in something like that that is democratic, well, I've voted for these people as well, so I have to go on with it.
I've got a question about working from home. I think it's a good one. Do you think that the increasing prevalence of remote work and online learning have contributed to the intolerance and vigilantism you've described by making it easier for people to withdraw physically from people who with whom they may disagree?
I think it does. I think that online, people are disassociated from the persons who they're attacking. It is much harder to walk up to someone and to abuse them to their face than it is to just type it out from your phone or from your iPad. And I think that there has been a loss, particularly because of COVID, of people knowing how to interact with other people in a socially acceptable way. Now, you can tell from the way I speak, I'm not someone who always adheres to the strictures of socially acceptable conduct. So I'm not in the politically correct category in the extreme. But I also think that there are certain things that a lot of young people have lost by not interacting personally with others enough in professional environments, at university, at school, at work.
How do your arguments in favour of freedom of association sit with the accepted sort of social mores like you lie with dogs, you catch fleas?
Well, again, it is trying to shame a person That's a great phrase, to shame a person because of who they're associating with. Now, people should own their friends. All of us have friends who have done things that we sort of roll our eyes and we think, I wish they hadn't done that, or I wish they hadn't said that. But again, it's a choice you make as a person within a community, reflecting upon your own conduct and the mistakes you've made as to whether you abandon someone who has been publicly identified as having engaged in some significant error, even if it amounts to a crime. And the fact that you haven't abandoned a person shouldn't be a shameful thing. It's a personal choice. And each of us make those choices every day. I remember there was a defamation case years ago where a shock jock in Sydney called the wife of a person accused of sexually harassing a staff member a grub. This woman, who had been married to him for years, was a grub for supporting her husband. Now, I mean, she had children with this man. She wasn't satisfied the allegations were necessarily true, but she was called a grub on radio. And one wonders, well, what was she supposed to do in that situation? I mean, some people may have divorced him and taken the children away, but perhaps she wasn't in a position to do that. You don't know a person's full story. And the problem with this sort of shaming in the media, you know what? Journalists don't personally know most of the people that they're attacking. And I think people need to, again, reflect upon their own lives and mistakes that they've made and consider whether they would wish to be completely abandoned by everyone they know because of errors that they've made. I mean, why not have the death penalty whenever you make a mistake? If that's the way we should socially approach people in that position.
Right, so we've got a final question, and I think this comes back to your definition of cancel culture as a subset within defamation. Given how you've described the media amplifies cancel culture, to what extent are large defamation payments against media organisations an effective way to curb that behaviour? And that is, should those payouts instead go to educating the public about norms of discourse or properly resourcing journalism or the things we can do to have a culture of restoration?
Well, if the payout doesn't go to the plaintiff, then the plaintiff probably won't sue. So that's going to be a problem. But, you know, why not have a dollar-for-dollar system where the payout goes to the plaintiff, as should occur, and the media organisation has to pay the same amount to those education systems? I mean, in Australia, we have a cap on damages in defamation. I think even over the last 6 months, Donald Trump has made $50 million or something in defamation settlements, US. So the amounts that media companies pay here is really barely anything compared to some of the amounts that are paid overseas. And it's also incomparable to the amount of money some media organisations make just from one round of advertising in the program in which they've defamed someone. So should the media be paying money when they've done the wrong thing for education and other systems? Sure, that's a great idea. But the plaintiff should be paid too if they've been defamed. Just like a person who loses a limb is paid compensation if it's been done because of a legal wrong.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt the discussion and questions, but we're going to be out of time for them. You've made the point powerfully and persuasively and mounted the case for cancelling cancel culture. And if it were up to me, I'd certainly rule in your favour.
That often happens.
Thank you so much, Sue. You are,
thank you.
Oh, you're
thank
most you welcome. Much.
And that was defamation barrister Sue Chrysanthou speaking with an audience at the Melbourne Law School at the University of Melbourne, and asking the questions was fellow barrister James Waters. Thanks to them, and also to co-hosts the Victorian Bar. And would you rule in her favour, I wonder? Hey, we love hearing from you about what you're hearing on the show, and our email address is bigideas@abc.net.au. Let it rip. Tell us what you think. Big Ideas is where you're at. Big thinkers at the best live events right here on ABC Radio National, but find all our episodes on the ABC Listen app. I'm your host, Natasha Mitchell. It's been great sharing this time with you. Bye for now. Catch you next time for more Big Ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.